The first story takes place in Florida. And we're changing the names of the families because they're personal stories. There was a family, we'll call them the Spitzers. And they had four children, and then 10 years went by where they didn't have any kids at all. And after 10 years that went by where they didn't have any children, suddenly the wife was expecting, and she was carrying five babies, and she gave birth to quintuplets. Now, they went from a very simple family with not such a great parnasa to suddenly having a lot of kids all at once, especially babies cost a lot. Formula, care, you need obviously nurses helping you with that. And they definitely were in need of a lot of money. And there was a wealthy old lady that lived alone in the community, and she heard about this family, and she gave them a lot of money. She gave like a big chunk of money to help take care of them during the first couple of years of having these five children. And one day, this old lady decides she wants to go visit the family that she's taking care of, like just to go meet the kids, see them, take a picture with them, or whatever it is. And she comes, we'll call her Mrs. Gordon. And Mrs. Gordon comes to the house, and she arranged beforehand to visit. And the mother opens the door, and she's showing her the kids in the living room. And all of a sudden, Mrs. Gordon looks up. She sees a huge picture that's hanging in the living room of a lady, and Mrs. Gordon faints. Like she gets shooken up, she turns pale, and she faints on the floor. And quickly, like the mother called an ambulance, and Mrs. Gordon slowly came back to herself, but was very adamant, and they brought her to the hospital to do tests and see what happened. So the next day, the mother decided, she's going to go visit this old lady, Mrs. Gordon, in the hospital, and visit her. And she said, "What was it about the picture that you saw hanging in the living room of my mother that made you get so emotional, that made you faint like that?" So she said, "That's your mother?" She said, "Let me tell you, I have to tell you a story. I can't believe it. Let me tell you a story." So she was a Holocaust survivor, Mrs. Gordon, and she had been in Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. And when she was there, she said she was between around 14, 15 years old. And there was a group of girls between the ages of 14 and 16 that all had become friendly. They were all from families. And they tried as secretly and as possible to do different mitzvos, say different tefillos, whenever they were able to get away with it. And in the last year before they were freed, so a bunch of these girls decided, okay, let's try to light Hanukkah candles. Is there any way that we could do it? And they figured, okay, fine, somebody has some margarine. If we melt the margarine, then we'll be able to light that. We'll pull some threads out of our garments, and that'll be the wick. Now we just need something that could hold the melted margarine. They're trying to think, what could be like the vessel that would hold it? Oh, maybe potatoes, like raw potatoes that the potato was dug out of it. That could be like a vessel for it. And they watched the kitchen area to see when was there not a guard guarding the kitchen. And they figured out the schedule of the nighttime watchman when they switch over. And they found like a 5-minute window of opportunity between, let's say, 12 and 12:05 at night where nobody was guarding the kitchen. They would just run in there, get one potato. They could dig out the insides of the potato, fill it up with the melted margarine, and they'll be able to light a Hanukkah candle. And five of the girls got together, and they went to the kitchen, and they got a potato, and they started running away. And the next Nazi guard came, caught them, screamed at them, yelled at them, locked them up, sent them back to their bunker, but wrote down their names, and they announced to everybody that the next day they were going to hang all these five girls. Like, that punishment by death, going, stealing a potato, breaking into the kitchen. And the girls are obviously broken and terrified and scared and trying to think, is there anything we could do to get out of this? What could we do? Trying to come up with ideas. And they knew there was one lady, one Jewish lady, that had more connections with the Germans because she knew a lot of different languages, and she served for them as an interpreter, where she would listen to the radio and tell the Germans what was being said on the radio so they would be up to date with the news. So because of that, they gave her extra food and they were nice to her. So they thought, maybe this lady could be like a connection for us. And they snuck to where this lady was to tell her that the next day they were supposed to all be hung publicly. And they asked her if she could help them. When they got to her, she was singing Ma'oz Tzur. She herself had secretly lit in a Hanukkah candle. But she said she can't help them. There's no way. She can't do it. She's not going to be able to do anything about it. And she chased them away. So the next day, all the Jews are gathered together in like a certain square, I guess, in Bergen-Belsen. And there are five nooses that are set up. And the five girls are standing on chairs with their heads tied inside the nooses. And there's five different Nazi guards that are behind each chair ready to kick it away as soon as they're given the signal to have them hung. And before the general, you know, blew the whistle or gave the command, whatever it is, suddenly that girl that they had asked for help came running to the general, started talking to him frantically, like in another language that they didn't know, like I guess in German or whatever it was. And the German was answering, and the general was answering, and she was responding. And it looked like they were like arguing, and the lady was like frantic, yelling at him and all that. And finally, like, he turned to the Nazi guards that were behind each chair, and he said, "Let them go." And they all took their, you know, they took their heads out of the nooses, and they chased them away. It saved their lives. And like 2-3 days later, the Americans came and they were liberated. And she said, like, I was one of those five girls, and I remembered the face of the lady that saved us. I didn't know her name. I don't know where she lived. I couldn't find her. My whole life, I grew up, like, imagining her face and wishing I'd just thank her. I never got to thank her for saving me and my friend's life. I've always been looking for her, and I dream about her and everything like that. And then I walk into your house, and I see the picture of her on the wall of your house. Your mother is the one that saved my life in Bergen-Belsen. And the daughter then said, "Now I understand the dream that I had." So she said, "What do you mean? What dream?" So she said, "The night before I gave birth to my five quintuplets, whatever it is, I saw my mother in a dream. And she said to me, in Yiddish, finf for finf, five for five." And I said, "Mama, what do you mean? What do you mean?" So, and she didn't tell me what she meant. And now I understand. For the five girls that you saved, for the five girls that my mother saved, that's why she was zochet to have those five quintuplets. That's story number one. What?
No.
It seemed late. Okay. Now I'll tell another story. This story happened 35 years ago. There's a cheder called Sheris Yisrael in Petach Tikva. And two twin boys, the ages of nine, they're both nine. One's name was Yair, one's name was Ariel. So they previously had been in a chiloni, like in a not religious elementary school in Kiryat Ono. And their mother, who had been chiloni, was now getting more religious and moved them to this cheder in Petach Tikva. What was the story? Why did this happen? So if a number of months earlier, her husband had been alive, and they all went on a trip in America. And it was two parents, these twin boys who were 8 and a half at the time, Yair and Ariel. And they also had a daughter whose name was Meirav, and she was 2 and a half years old. They were driving a station wagon in America, and there was a snowstorm that wasn't expected. They didn't know, and they were driving on very windy roads, and there was like a sudden turn, and the father who was driving didn't see a cliff, and it was a 200 meter drop down. The car was like rolling and smashed on a tree stump on the bottom, and for a few minutes all of them were unconscious, like out of it. And the mother woke up first, and she was in terrible pain and bleeding everywhere. But obviously the first thing a mother wants to do is see, you know, what's with her kids. She looked where her husband's seat was. He wasn't in his seat. She couldn't turn her back to see her kids, but she screamed like, you know, "Ariel, Ariel, Ariel." And like she screamed it a few times, so finally he said, yeah, what? Like as like he was like waking up from his sleep. So she said, "How is Yair? Call Yair, Yair, Yair." And then Uriel was like pushing Yair, 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 Yair. Yair woke up and said, "Yeah, what? Mom, I think we were in an accident. You have blood all over your face." So then the mother said, "What about Meirav? How's Meirav? Look in the back of the car. It was a station wagon. Like, how's Meirav?" And they looked to the back of the car, and the whole back of the car was just completely crushed and schmutzed, like, entirely. And they, like, and didn't look like Meirav would have had any chance. And the mother rolled herself out of the car and was, like, crawling across the snow, bleeding everywhere. But all she had in mind is, "Where's Meirav? Where's Meirav?" And she sees the back of the car is just, like, completely total, like, crushed, schmushed, like, there's no way that Meirav made it, and she's just sobbing and sobbing and sobbing on the floor. And suddenly, like, she hears footsteps next to her, and she picks up her head, and there's Meirav. And Meirav says, you know, Mommy, I think Abba's sleeping. I can't wake Abba up. And she points, like, to where Abba is, and his wife saw that her husband was dead, but Meirav was alive. And the ambulances came, Hatzalah came, whatever it is. The mother was very injured, and it took her months to recuperate, but the kids, not any one of the three of them, didn't even have a scratch. They were completely fine, didn't even need to be in the hospital longer than just to get checked and make sure that everything was okay. Her husband had passed away, and they stayed in America for a few months until the mother recuperated, and it was really just like a miracle story for the children, that 200-meter drop like that, and they still made it out okay. And that already would be enough of a story, but that's not the story. That's the background of the story. The mother, during all this time of recuperating, realized that, okay, like, this was a miracle that happened to my family. We can't just, like, go on regular. And she slowly, you know, started being Chozer B'tshuva. And she decided to take her kids out of this Chiloni school and send them to, you know, a religious Orthodox school. And she moved these kids. They're 9 years old now. They don't have any Torah background, not Chumash, not Mishnah, not anything. And it was very hard to get used to being religious kids, learning how to learn. But they were both very smart, and they picked up the Chumash, they picked up the Mishnah. But when it came to the Gemara, Ariel started having a lot of complications. Like, he wasn't understanding it, wasn't going in. The Rebbe tried to sit with him, and he wasn't hopping. And one day, like, Ariel said, I don't want to go to school tomorrow. Tomorrow there's a test. I don't know the Gemara at all. Like, what's the point? I don't want to go to school. And the mother understood where he was coming from. She's like, okay, fine. You don't have to go to school. Like, I write the Rebbe a note. You'll stay home tomorrow. Don't worry. It'll be okay. He goes to sleep. The next morning, Ariel wakes up. He gets dressed for school, takes his bag, starts to walk out the house. His mother says, what do you mean? I thought you don't want to go to school today. You have a test. You're not ready for it. You're going to stay home. He's like, no. I'm going to be okay. He's like, what do you mean you're going to be okay? You know the story? She's like, yeah. So he said, no, last night something happened. So she's like, what do you mean? What happened? She's like, I had a dream. Abba came to me in a dream. Yeah. And Abba taught me the whole Gemara. She's like, what? What do you mean? Your father doesn't know Gemara. She's like, yeah, I know. That's what I told him. My father came to me in a dream. He had a long beard and payas. His father had been Chiloni. And he said, I'm going to teach you the Gemara. And I said to him, Abba, you don't know Gemara. You're not religious. You never learned Gemara before. So he said, no. Because you and your ear are learning Torah, I was put into Gan Eden. And in Gan Eden, whatever you're learning, they teach me too. And therefore, all the Gemara that you were learning, they taught me also in Shemayim. And I listen very well and I know it. And it's also because your ear learned it well and he understands it. And I'm going to teach it to you now. And he taught him the whole night in the dream, the Gemara. And Ariel felt completely ready. And the mother, like, didn't want to break her son's heart, but she thought, okay, like, he's an orphan, he misses his father, like, this didn't, like, you know, whatever. And then they said, wait, and Abba also told me to tell you something. Abba told me to tell you that he wants you to know that you made a very good choice in the direction that you're bringing the family, and to keep on going in the way that you're going. And she heard that, like, she broke down crying, and she wasn't going to stop him going to school, but she was scared that his heart would be broken when he wouldn't actually know the Gemara. But he took the test, and he knew it perfectly inside out, backwards, forwards. The Rebbe looked at it, like, he knew that the kid, like, he had sat with him the day before. He didn't know anything, the Rebbe said. Like, and, like, all of a sudden, he read the test, and the kid got everything perfectly right, like, the best student, 100. So he decided to call up the mother, make her really happy, you know, and say, your son got 100. Like, who tutored him? Like, I saw him yesterday, he didn't know anything. Like, who tutored him? And the mother said, you're not going to believe it. You're not going to believe it. Like, he said his father came to him in a dream and taught them. And the father was like, what? He's like, I'm telling you, ask him yourself, tell him to tell you the whole story. And he came to and the Rebbe called him in, and he was in the Rebbe's room, so the other Rebbeim around, and he asked the kid what happened, and he told him over the dream, and when he got to the part of, and whatever they learn in Shemayim, whatever we learn here in this world, our father is learning also in Gan Eden. Like, all the Rebbe's there, like, got, like, a shudder because, like, some of them were missing a father or a grandfather, and, like, they realized, like, literally how their own learning, like, affects them in Gan Eden. And the family kept on going that direction. They ended up picking up and moving to Ramat El Hanan and Bnei Brak, and by now already they got married. This is these two twin brothers that are learning in Kollel today. The story happened 35 years ago. It was written up in the newspaper back then. That ties in, that's similar, not similar, but interesting other story. I haven't told this in a while, but did I ever tell you my mother-in-law's dream? My mother-in-law has a lot of dreams, my wife's mother. She has a lot of dreams, a lot of true dreams. Before she would have every one of her 18 children, she would like have a dream like what she was having or something about them or people, just tons of dreams. And she grew up like that, even as like a little girl having dreams. And her father died when she was like 16 or 17 years old. The night before that, she had a dream of like a thunderstorm with big, huge trees falling down. And she knew that something foreboding was going to happen. So, but after he died, she was always waiting to have a dream about him, to see him in a dream, for him to tell her something in a dream, like to some sign of something that he knew what was going on in her life. And she didn't dream anything about him. And she was set up, she's the oldest in her family, and she was set up at a young age to get married, to marry off these orphan girls. And she set up with my father-in-law, and she was waiting, like the wedding night at least, or the night before the wedding, or the night after the wedding, or at some point during Shavuot Brachos, that my father should come to me in a dream, say Mazel Tov, something like, she has other dreams, like, I want to see my father in a dream. Nothing. Silence in that area. Fine. They needed to move to America for a year. My father-in-law was, his parents lived in Connecticut. He had to finish up getting his degree or whatever it was at the time. So they moved to America for 1 year or for a certain number of months. During that year, my mother-in-law missed her best friend's wedding in Israel. Her best friend got engaged, she was getting married. And like, it was so hard for her not to be there. Like, it was just painful not to be at her best friend's wedding. So she decided, okay, so I can't be there, but I'll celebrate for her over here. And nobody was home, everybody was at work, and she sat at the table in her in-law's house, like a white tablecloth, nice china, put out cups, like turned on music or whatever it was, like made like a whole like wedding type of little situation in the house, and literally just like made, cooked really fancy food, and made a party for her friend alone, you know, in her in-law's house, trapped in America away from the wedding. That night, she has a dream. And in the dream, my mother-in-law said she was walking in a beautiful, beautiful garden. And it was like the most unbelievable feeling, most beautiful flowers and trees and fruits. And like, she knew she was in Gan Eden. And she's walking, and she gets to a bench. And she sees on the bench two very prestigious rabbanim talking to each other. One of them was her father, who was a big rav. And the other one was Rabbi Kiva Eger. And she never saw a picture of Rabbi Kiva Eger before. She knew what Rabbi Kiva Eger looked like. But she knew in the dream this was Rabbi Kiva Eger. And they were talking to each other and learning. And they looked happy. And I don't think her father looked at her or said anything to her. But she saw her father in Gan Eden talking Torah with Rabbi Kiva Eger. And she woke up and she had just such a good feeling. Like the best feeling. And she didn't know what to make of it. Why specifically Rabbi Kiva Eger? Why'd she finally have this dream now? Many years later, I don't know how many, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So my in-laws have guests, you know, they try to have guests every single Shabbos. And often they have Bachrim from the Mir because they live right near the Mir. And one day they had like a whole Seudah with Mir Bachrim. And they were one of the Bachrim were talking about how like, you know, sometimes you miss your friend's wedding because they're in America, or you're in America and they're in Israel. But there's something called Sudas Rabbi Kiva Eger. And then my mom said, what? Yes, Sudas Rabbi Kiva Eger. You know, if you miss your friend's wedding. She's like, what is that? What do you mean? Yeah, Rabbi Kiva Eger said, if you can't be at your friend's wedding or whatever it is, you celebrate yourself. You know, you're supposed to feel somebody else's pain. You're also supposed to feel somebody else's simcha. You make a seuda by yourself, like to celebrate your friend's, you know, chasana, whatever it is. If you can't make it, that's called Sudas Rabbi Kiva Eger. Everybody knows about it. We make like that matzah of an Amir Dira whenever one of our friends in America gets married. You make a Sudas Rabbi Kiva Eger. And she's like, whoa. And then she understood why she saw her father, specifically that night, learning with Rabbi Kiva Eger in Gan Eden. Another story. This is also an unbelievable story. It was a gimmick a couple of years ago, it happened. Not even so long ago, Rav Chaim Kanievsky's in the story. And the guy that told the story, he told the story over a few days after it happened. He was shaking. He was very moved. There's a lot of witnesses to this story. It's very well recorded. Nothing added. It's exactly detailed after detail. He lived in Ramat Aharon, which is right on the outskirts of Bnei Brak, or in Bnei Brak. And on a Friday night, he had a dream. He was sleeping. Friday night, he had a dream. And in his dream, he was 60 years old at the time. And in his dream, he saw his parents that passed away a long time ago. And grandparents of his, and aunts and uncles, whoever passed away, he saw them in his dream. And they were all smiling at him and happy to see him, and he was happy to see them. And then his father said to him, they want to call you to the Beis Din Shamala to give testimony about something that happened to you 43 years ago that only you can give testimony about because only you know about. And, no, sorry, 48 years ago. No, no, 43 years ago. And he said, and then the father continued, they wanted to call you up to Beis Din Shamala 2 years ago to give this testimony, but you were only 58 at the time. So they waited till you're 60, and now they want to invite you to the Beis Din Shamala to give testimony on this situation. And he said, but I don't want to go. I don't want to leave yet. I don't want to come yet to Shamayim. And his parents said to him, who says that once you get here, you're not going to like it? It's very nice up here. It's very good. It could be when you come, you're going to be very happy here. But you're right. It is better not to come yet. It's better to stick it out, you know, longer in this world. But they want you to come to Beis Din Shamala. So he said, so what should I do? What should I do? I don't want to come yet. So they said, go ask the Rav. What Rav? What Rav should I go to? Rav Chaim Knievsky. And then he woke up. What? Not that he should, that he's, when you're invited to Beis Din Shamala, it's not always a good thing. So then he wakes up at 4 a.m, and his heart's pounding. The first thing he thought about is, whoa, that's what it means in the Torah when it says that when Paro woke up from his dreams, it says, Vatipa emrucho, that like his heart was thumping like after having those dreams. That was like a very real, real, real dream. And he said, and I understood exactly what they were talking about. I knew what they meant when they said what happened 43 years ago. I knew what they wanted me to testify on. And I even knew what they meant when they said that they wanted to invite me 2 years ago, and they decided to wait two more years. He said, 43 years ago, I was in, let's say, yeshiva katana, like high school age learning in yeshiva. It's a big yeshiva with 300 bachrim in the base midrash. And one morning, I'm learning with my gemara, and one of the guys in the yeshiva came over to me and said, that's my gemara. She said, no, it's not, it's my gemara. I said, no, that's my gemara. He said, no, it's my gemara. And he kept on learning with it. So that guy went and told one of the rabbanim. And the Rav said, call him over. You know the story? The Rav said, call him over to me, tell him to come. So the friend said, the Rebbe wants to speak to you. So he comes over with the Gemara, and the Rebbe said, why did you steal his Gemara? He said, I didn't steal his Gemara. It's my Gemara. It's not his Gemara. And then the Rebbe picked up his hand and gave him a huge smack in the face, and it was like a loud pop, like a very loud slap. The whole base midrash got silent. All eyes turned, and the 300 bachrim all looked and saw how the Rebbe smacked him, took the Gemara. It was and like he was, it was terribly humiliated and embarrassed in front of everybody. He was like shaking and pale, and he walked out of the base midrash and like he didn't know what to do with himself. He was like, and he really had not stolen the Gemara.
It was his Gemara.
What, he didn't steal it. And he was so shooken up, so terribly humiliated in front of the whole yeshiva. And he's walking and he bumps into the Rosh Yeshiva, who is outside. The Rosh Yeshiva sees that he's shooken up. He said, What happened? He told him the whole story. The Rosh Yeshiva realized that something very wrong happened. And the Rosh Yeshiva said to him, he said, listen, I understand if you don't want to listen to my advice. You know, what happened to you is very unfortunate, very sad, and you know, you're right for feeling the way that you feel. I ask you if you could not tell this story to anybody and to let it go. You don't have to listen to me, but I ask you not to tell anybody. And I decided to keep it in. I didn't even tell my parents. I went home. They saw that I was bothered. I said I didn't feel well. I didn't go to yeshiva for a few days. Made believe I was sick. But I never told anybody. I'm the only one in the whole world that really knows the true story that happened over here. And I carry this with me for the last 43 years. He said, 4 years ago, I decided I want to go visit my yeshiva. It's been, 39 years that went by since I went to this yeshiva. And I decided to go visit the yeshiva. And I'm visiting the Rebbeim, and I'm seeing the building and looking where my old room was. And I decided I'm even going to go visit this Rebbe that smacked me. I knew where he lived, and he lived right near the yeshiva. And he was an old man by now, 39 years later. You can imagine, he's an old man. He knocks on the door. And so I said, he's not so well, he's not such a good time. He said, okay, just visit him for a few minutes. So I said, okay, just a few minutes, you can come in. He walks into the room. This was 4 years before the dream. And he sees the Rebbe's there. He looks old and not so well, but he has like a twitch. And his twitch, it's like this. And he said, like, it looks like somebody that's just being smacked over and over and over again, their face like being pushed to the side. And I asked, what happened? Like, what happened to him? So she said, no one really knows. The doctors can't explain it. It's not Parkinson's. He just started this twitch randomly like a couple of years ago. It doesn't go away. It's very, very embarrassing to him, like in front of his students, in front of other people. He's not comfortable walking outside so much. But and he stinked himself. I know exactly why it's happening to him. And like this looks like somebody's being slapped over and over and over again. And he didn't tell the wife, I know why it's happening to your husband. But he was very shooken up from what he saw. 2 years later, meaning 2 years ago, I forgot where he was at the time, but he suddenly felt terrible, terrible, terrible chest pains. His family called an ambulance. He was rushed to the hospital, Tel HaShomer. And they said, you're having a heart attack. If you would have gotten here a half an hour later, we couldn't have saved your life. And his life was saved, and 2 more years passed. So I know exactly what they meant in the dream, that 2 years ago they wanted me to come testify in Shemayim, but they decided to wait until I'm 60. But now it's 4 a.m. He just had this dream. They're inviting him to the Beis Din Shamala. And he's supposed to go find Rav Chaim Kanievsky. He runs down the streets. He knows where Rav Chaim Kanievsky davens Vasikin in the Letterman Shul. You'll be there next year in Shana Bet, probably in Mitzvah Shem Amen. And he goes to the Vasikin Minyan. And right before Rav Chaim goes back home, he asks the Gaboim and the sons, like, could I talk to Rav Chaim? Could I talk to Rav Chaim? So they said, now he's going to Seuda. It's not the right time. You'll come later. So no. I was sent to Minas Shemayim to talk to him. So they're like, quiet, like, what do you mean? You told him the dream. It's like, okay, fine. This sounds like exciting. So they take him into the room, and he tells Reb Chaim the whole story. And Reb Chaim says, it's a dream. Chalomo shavi deberun. It's a dream. Don't take it seriously. He said, no, but it felt very real. What could I do? I don't want to go to Beis Din Shamala. What do I do? So Reb Chaim said, okay, you can get together a group of three Rabbanim, and in front of them you could be Mochel the Rebbe. So they got together, three Rabbanim right there and then, and he said that he's Mocha the Rebbe, but he still didn't feel good about it, the old man that had the dream. And he said to Reb Chaim, can I go to the Rebbe's house and be Mocha him? Is there any benefit to that? So Reb Chaim said, yeah, you could do that. That could also help. So the next morning, Sunday morning, he traveled to the Rebbe's house. He knocks on the door. Nobody answers. He knocks and knocks. Finally, he asked the neighbor what's going on. So he said, oh, Friday night, the Rav was rushed to the hospital, an emergency, Friday night, around the time that he had the dream. The Rebbe was rushed to the hospital. He's in the emergency room, and it doesn't look very good. Found out which hospital, what room. He ran to the emergency room. The family is gathered around him, and the doctor's saying it doesn't look very good. And he said, can I go talk to your father? Can I talk to your father? He's like, sorry, now's not a good time. He's not... He can't really talk to anybody. He said, no, I have to be mochim for something that he did to me many years ago. And the kid's like, this isn't the right time. Why are you bringing this up now? He said, no. He told him the dream. He told him that Reb Chaim said to come. And he didn't tell him the story. He just told him about the dream. And they said, okay, fine, you can go in. And they left the room, and he went to the old Rebbe. And he said, and the Rebbe was still conscious, but like very weak and out of it. And he said, does the Rav remember my name is so-and-so? And does the Rav remember the story that, and it was like very hard for me to say and embarrass him like that, but like I pushed myself to do it. Does the Rav remember the story with the Gemara and the Rebbe slapped me? I was so embarrassed. I really wasn't the one that stole the Gemara. And it was very painful for me and I was so embarrassed or whatever it is. I want to tell the Rav that I'm mocha him completely for what happened. And I want to ask the Rav for Mechila that I didn't listen to the Rav right away and give the Gemara to my friend when the Rebbe told me to. And the Rebbe said, oh, yeah, he's also a mochel. And now he left the hospital and he felt like a stone lifted off his heart. He felt, okay, good. And he gets back in the car, he goes back home. Right when he walks to the house, his phone rings. It's one of the children of the Rebbe. And the child is like, you don't believe it, you don't believe it. Right after you left, the whole situation turned around. He started to get better and better. His heartbeat was getting stronger. He was starting to communicate better. His voice was stronger. Everything was better, and like the doctors are just like shocked how everything turned around. And over the next couple of days, he just got better and better and better. And within a week, he was freed from the hospital. And not only that, the twitch went away. His head stopped flapping all the way to the side. And he went back to visit the Rebbe a week later. And again, do the whole like mechila on both sides. And they're both amazed in the story. And they said, wait, but you know, there's a third person in this story that we have to involve over here. The kid that said I stole the Gemara. And we have to be mochel him, he has to be mochel us. And they tried to track him down. And they found out that a number of years earlier, he went crazy and he was in a mental institution. And they couldn't talk to him anymore. So that opportunity to talk to him had passed. I have more stories. That's the end of that story.
No. Did he find the kid and talk to him and heal him?
He was too late.
Is there a too late?
Don't accuse people.
Yeah, there's a story with Rav Yashiv where a bunch of girls in a class teased a certain girl very badly and like humiliated her to the point that she literally became like, she went off, like mentally off, and was sent to a mental institution. And the girls felt horrible and terrible, and they wanted mechila, but a shota can't be mochel. And they went to Rav Yashiv and said, what can we do to be chozer b'tshuva? Like, what can we do to get mechila from her? Like, what do we do? What do we do? And Rav Yashiv said, there's nothing that you could do. There's no way you can get tshuva for this, other than when she passes away, whenever that is, it could be in 100 years from now, you can go to her kever and ask for mechila with a group of 10 people. But until then, there's no way for you to be able to get mechila for what you did to her. So we have to be so, so careful with not embarrassing other people. Anybody that embarrasses up to be mochel them, believe shalem. Because look at this old man also. You know, the Gemara says that if somebody is punished because of you, I mean, they did something wrong, but and they hurt you, and you're not mocha them, and they're punished because of you, that person isn't zocha to see the Pnei Shechina, whatever that means. In other words, he also isn't allowed to enter the mechitza of the Shechina in Shamayim. In other words, it's not good even for you, for somebody else to be punished for what they did to you. We have to be mocha people, believe shalim. And you see this guy at the age of 60 would have had to go into Shamayim and died at that age to testify for his Rebbe when he didn't do anything wrong. The Rebbe is the one that did something wrong. So it's very important to be mocha people, no matter what, how bad, whatever it is they did to us, but to work on ourselves, to be mocha, whatever it is that people do to us. And hopefully, in that merit, Hashem will put in the hearts of the people that we wrong to be mocha us. Yeah. You want more stories? It's enough, too heavy now. Let these sink in.
One more.
Yeah. Raise your hands if you want another story.
Are you connected?
12 minutes later. No, I'm not even something. It looks like Rove. It looks like Rove. Okay. I have two stories to choose from. One is similar to the others, but another crazy story that happened 2 years ago in Williamsburg. And one is very different than those, but also happened in Williamsburg. Which one do you want?
The one in Williamsburg.
The better one.
Everyone can take another cookie.
The crazier one.
I'll tell you, they're both crazy, but I'll say the one that's more different than the other stories. So it'll be like a different message maybe. But this one I'm going to read to you, okay? Because too many details I didn't memorize. Okay. On Monday, October 15th, Chesed Shel Emes members were inspired by a moving incident which helped bring a woman to Kevi Yisrael. Who knows what's Chesed Shel Emes organizations? It's people that find Jewish dead bodies that nobody is there to take care of them. There's nobody there to bury them. There's no family members left behind. Nobody's claiming the body. And they make sure they have a Jewish burial and they put in a Jewish cemetery. And otherwise, what happens in America, if nobody claims a body, they end up doing like studies on it and stuff like that. So there was some woman who her body wasn't claimed. Rabbi Rosenberg received a phone call from a man who said he had been contacted by the New York City medical examiner in reference to the body of a woman by the name of Mrs. Schwartz. The medical examiner said that the body was at his office, and this man's name was listed as a contact since he was a neighbor of Mrs. Schwartz. Okay, one of Mrs. Schwartz's neighbor was called a long time after she had passed away. Her body was sitting in a freezer somewhere. He added that the body was supposed to be sent the next day to a university where it would be used for medical research. This was like the last call. Do you know anybody to claim this body? All we could track down was you, who was her neighbor. But he was her neighbor 10 years earlier because she's been in a nursing home since then. So he hasn't seen this lady for a long time. Rabbi Rosenberg wasted no time in investigating the matter. It turned out that the woman had passed away in New York Methodist Hospital on August 3rd. Right now it's already October. And on August 17th, the hospital sent her body to the medical examiner's office. Rabbi Rosenberg contacted the hospital and was told that the woman had been brought there from a nursing home. So he went to the nursing home. The nursing home that she had been in the nursing home for 10 years, but her original address was 85 Taylor Street in Williamsburg. Anybody know that street?
Sure.
Okay.
Anybody know Williamsburg?
Any cousins there, Chaim? Arye? Chaikin? Chesed Shel Emes volunteers. Chesed Shel Emes volunteers were immediately sent to 85 Taylor Street, 10 years after she hasn't been there, and asked the neighbors if they remembered Mrs. Schwartz. Even though some people remembered her, they didn't know her by the first name, and they didn't even remember her husband's name, but they knew that the husband passed away around 20 years ago, and the husband is buried somewhere. One neighbor said he thought the husband's name was Avraham Mordechai Schwartz, and that he was buried in the Sigurdur Chalka, like the Sigurdur portion of the cemetery in New Jersey. However, when they looked in the Sigurdur Chalka, they couldn't find any records by a man of the name of Avraham Mordechai Schwartz. So they were still stuck. On Tuesday morning, the day after Rosenberg had arranged for the release of the body, like he was claiming the body, but he didn't know what to do, but where to bury it. So the Chesed Shel Emes organization was arranging stam for a regular burial. But he suddenly, Rabbi Rosenberg, got a phone call from Mr. Aaron Orenstein from Williamsburg, who said the following. Okay, Aaron Orenstein from Williamsburg called Rabbi Rosenberg, who was claiming the body but didn't know where to bury it. He gets this phone call. His mother-in-law used to visit an elderly childless couple on 85 Taylor Street in Williamsburg. Occasionally, when his mother-in-law couldn't go, his wife, Mr. Orenstein's wife, as a child, would go to visit this elderly couple who didn't have kids. Sometimes, after she was married, she even took some of her kids with her. Last night, the husband of the elderly couple came to her in a dream.
Oh, no.
Came to Mrs. Orenstein in a dream and said, "My name is Moshe Zev, and I am buried in the Sigurdur Chalka in the third row behind the fence." Mr. Orenstein ignored the dream and didn't pay attention to it. But that day, her son from Lakewood, who she used to sometimes bring with her when he was a little kid to visit them, called her, and he had an identical dream. Mr. Schwartz came to him also in a dream and said, "My name is Moshe Zed, and I'm buried in the Sigurdur Chalka in the third row behind the fence." So immediately, Mr. Orenstein took it seriously. He ran to 85 Taylor Street. He didn't know what else to do. He didn't know who to tell this dream to. So he went to the address of where the old lady used to live and asked around, "Anything going over here?" And the neighbor said, "Well, yesterday Chesed Shel Emes members had come here looking if anybody knew where this husband had been buried, and they couldn't figure it out. And their dream answered the question. And sure enough, they look, and that's where he's buried. There's an empty plot next to him, and they found the papers that actually had been bought for his wife to be buried, and she was zochah to be buried where she was supposed to be. right next to her husband, 3 months after she had passed away.
Wow.
Shkayach.
Hey,